A Florida hospital enters the cryptocurrency game. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Nicholas Children's Hospital Foundation is now accepting cryptocurrency as donations. What are the pros and cons of using this form of money for charity? Also, it was 20 years ago when Roger Abramson created the giant menorah and dreidel on Miami Beach out of seashells. We'll talk to him about the inspiration for it and keeping it going all these years later. And finally,
he struggled with addiction in the past. He's spent time in jail. He's been convicted of several crimes. And now he says he's come out on the other side of that.
Few people have heard of Jason Mariner, and he likely will lose his run for Congress in District 20. But we'll find out why his campaign could be impactful for felons in Florida. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Cryptocurrency is quickly moving into many areas of life, most recently charities. The Nicholas Children's Hospital Foundation in Miami now accepts donations in Bitcoin and other digital currencies. The nonprofit is dedicated to raising money for patients and families in need. Now, it's among the first in South Florida to make the move in accepting donations in this way, but crypto's not new to our area. Several cities have talked about getting in on it, too. Now, cryptocurrency is a digital currency where transactions are verified and maintained by a decentralized system. In other words, there's no bank or central authority. And it's also in the news a lot for rising values and multiple scams. WLRN's healthcare reporter Veronica Zaragovi has been following this story, and she joins us now. Veronica, what is it about these virtual currencies that is attracting charities like the Nicholas Children's Hospital Foundation?
Right, Luis. Well, what they've explained to me in my reporting is that actually donors have contacted them in order to find out if they could give using crypto instead of cash, or there are many other ways you can donate stock, you can give real estate. And these tend to be younger donors, usually millennials, who have made very large gains with cryptocurrency, and they want to do some good. And so, of course, a hospital would be one place that they consider. And so that's why, you know, these hospitals have told me that they don't want to leave the money on the table, because it's not like the donor's going to be like, oh, you don't take crypto, so we'll just give you a cash donation. It doesn't work like that.
So is there demand for donors to give in crypto right now?
There are more, you know, it's a small fraction of charitable giving, but a growing one. I mean, there around the country, there have been very large amounts. I interviewed, for instance, a Cape Cod Healthcare Foundation in Massachusetts, one of the hospitals taking crypto, and they received almost $1 million from one anonymous donor. So there is a growing demand, and these hospitals don't want to miss out.
So you spoke with Pat Duffy. He is the co-founder of the Giving Block. That's a digital platform that helps nonprofits receive crypto and turn it into cash.
Just like stocks, it's more tax optimized to donate crypto to a nonprofit than it is to donate U.S. dollars. The issue was no nonprofits were equipped to accept it. We decided we're going to help nonprofits build what we call crypto philanthropy programs.
Do donors benefit from the tax savings?
Right. So they don't pay taxes on their capital gains to the Internal Revenue Service. And so that's one of the main draws, and that's why they would give crypto and not cash, because then the nonprofit gets the full donation and then the donor gets a tax write-off and doesn't pay taxes on those capital gains.
So when these cryptocurrency donations come in, what is it? Do you convert it to cash at that point?
Well, the sources I've spoken to say you first need to follow donor intent. So if that donor gave you instructions on what to do, then of course you would do that. But if not, then most people advise you got to cash that right away, because the volatility that I know we're going to talk about is just so extreme that that's one reason to just cash it right away.
Yeah, I give $1 million, it's $1 million. But cryptocurrency is volatile. It goes up, it goes down. I mean, isn't there a concern there?
Yes, there's definitely a concern. And one of these hospitals that I spoke to, it told me that in that week when they got the call from the donor wanting to give crypto, they said, okay, we've got to pay one of these wallet services, like they're called Coinbase or the Giving Block from Pat Duffy or Ngiven. These are digital, like e-commerce platforms that enable you to take the Bitcoin and cash it. And in that time they were getting set up and choosing one, Bitcoin's value dropped. And so they're watching this potential donation like start going down. And, you know, during the pandemic, hospitals have become so cash strapped.
So couldn't they also just say, hey, let's hold it for a while because it could go up?
They could. And they just take a big risk, though, because it fluctuates so much. It could be Elon Musk sending out a tweet and then the value will plummet by 50%. And so
always wait for him to send out a tweet and do something. Well, no, because I mean, there was an interesting story from the co-founder of the cryptocurrency Ethereum, who donated $1 billion to the India COVID relief fund. And, you know, later on, we found out that only 20 million had been used because of, again, converting cryptocurrency. So there's a lot going on there. Another set of concerns, fraud and scams. I mentioned this earlier. We've seen countries outlaw these transactions because of scams and money laundering and terrorists. What are the concerns that come up for organizations like this trust fund, specifically when it comes to these kind of problems?
I had turned to experts like William Luther. He's an economics professor at FAU at Florida Atlantic University who studies cryptocurrencies. And he explained that because the donors can be anonymous, then a hospital might not know if that person could be linked to a problem like, let's say, the Sackler family. So then you as a hospital entity have to decide if there is a problem with the donor, would you give back money that you desperately need? But at the same time, because it's anonymous, it might help with the public relations because you're kind of shielded in that you might not need to disclose to the public who that donor was. So it's something that the advice that experts have told me is that these hospitals need to be prepared. They need to have these discussions and they need to decide if this is aligned with their mission or not.
So one of the other big things that came out with cryptocurrency is that this thing they do, which is mining, which is finding more coin, is bad for the environment, the impact. So what about that?
Well, part of what goes on in that mining is when you're doing these math problems to verify that the transaction is legit, that the owner is the owner and that the money wasn't spent beforehand. And these are computer networks that are operating around the clock and they process these transactions in batches. And they're very powerful. They eat up a lot of electricity. And so there are some organizations that feel like, you know, this electricity is made sometimes from coal mining. It's not all wind farms and solar panels. And so that may very well contribute to global warming if you're adding a lot of, if you're part of this network that consumes a lot of energy.
And of course, conversations about bringing one of these mining, computer systems to South Florida and how much energy that's going to take up, but that's a whole nother story. When talking about cryptocurrency and South Florida, we have to talk about Miami City Mayor Francis Suarez. He's been very big on pushing for the city to do business in this currency and to really move into that direction. And that would be, I think, a first, right? Like the first municipality in the U.S. to do this? I mean, where do we stand on that?
Yeah, that's what it seems to be, that Miami is trying to wants to be the first city in the country to give a Bitcoin yield to its residents. Mayor Suarez has also said he'd like to earn his income in Bitcoin and allow city employees to make that decision as well. So, you know, and actually I wanted to mention that when I spoke to Nicholas Children's, they mentioned that because they're here in Miami and it's becoming a growing tech scene, that they wanted to be able to meet their donors where they are. And if there are a lot of tech-savvy people here trading in cryptocurrency, that they would be able to do that. So it certainly helps that Miami is paying a lot of attention to it to generate more donations. But that's a whole other...
I'd wondered if, I mean, and with the hospital too, have we seen any organization like that anywhere in the world do it that we could say, yeah, that works?
You mean similar to what Mayor Suarez wants to do? You know, in my reporting, because I've been so focused on the hospitals, I don't know that other, say, municipalities have done it. But certainly this is newer to hospitals and they're just figuring this out slowly. I mean, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, maybe many of us have received those mailers asking for money. They're also taking crypto in order to tap into foreign donors because there's no middleman. There's no bank that's charging a conversion, a foreign currency transaction fee. So, you know, that's part of the allure.
This is a fascinating story. I guess it's the way of the world. We're heading in this direction. The Nicholas Children's Hospital Foundation in Miami now accepting donations in Bitcoin and other digital currencies. You could read more of this story and more of Veronica's reporting on this story on our website, WLRN.org. And she is the healthcare reporter, but covering a lot of crypto. I guess she's become like the crypto, expert now. So if I want to go in that direction, I'll ask her. Veronica, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lewis.
And again, you could read more on this story and her reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the man behind a notable menorah in Miami Beach shares his love of seashells. That's all coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support during this winter membership campaign. Now, you may have seen it if you've walked along Lincoln Road in Miami Beach. Two massive sculptures stand in honor of Hanukkah. These two sculptures, a menorah and a dreidel, are favorites for locals and tourists to get those beautiful Instagram photos. And they're staying up long past the holiday and the rest of this holiday season. But who made those big art pieces out of seashells? And I know you've seen them. They're beautiful. If you have seen those two sculptures, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Twitter or Facebook, WLRN Sundial, and connect with us. And by the way, if you've taken a picture, share your photos with us. Again, they're the giant menorah and the dreidel that they have out there on Lincoln Road in Miami Beach. And again, I just want to take a moment as we, again, are trying to connect with the artist, Roger Abramson. Thank you again for your support during this winter membership campaign. You can pledge your support now for programs like this one. I'm just going to throw out the number for you, 866-247-9576. Thank you so much for that. You know what? While we're trying to get him connected, you know what? The other thing, too, I wanted to ask is you could share with us on social media how you celebrated Hanukkah. I believe Hanukkah last night, if Hanukkah was last night. Share with us again on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We're going to be talking with Roger Abramson. He is the artist behind the giant menorah and dreidel on Miami Beach here on Lincoln Road. He made them out of seashells, and we're going to share with him stories of how he put those together. Roger, do I finally got you?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, Roger, great to have you. Sorry about that, but you know what? Technology is a fickle thing. Roger, I got to know, because you put these things together 20 years ago. What was the inspiration? Why do you want to do this?
It's of good things that you want to be part of. And when I did this, I was thinking not only of Judaism, but I was thinking the fact that shells are so non-confrontational that everyone could enjoy them.
And Roger, I apologize because you cut in and out there for a second on that answer. My deepest apologies. We're trying to get this technology set up. We're trying to get our connection right. Why a menorah? Why a dreidel?
Well, the menorah represents the 8 days of Hanukkah, the festival of lights. You know, originally it was thought, this goes back to 2,000 years ago, in 200 BC, it was a particularly difficult time for Jews, and there was a king and his son who decided to absolutely kill all the Jews that he could find, and it was also a question of them, the Jewish people, believing in some Greek god, and they destroyed the second temple. And this made a lot of people very angry, particularly Judas Maccabee. It was like a revolution, a guerrilla revolution. And they ended up taking over again from a major army. And the Hanukkah menorah represents, each day of Hanukkah represents that new hope and that feeling of happiness. And Hanukkah is a very happy holiday. It's a holiday of gifts and giving, and it's something which almost, I noticed having the menorah there for the last 20 years, the people who have taken their pictures in front of it and seen it, they have been from every walk of life and religion and race, and it gives me a lot of comfort to know that it has that kind of appeal.
Yeah. And again, you know, because you're mentioning again why out of seashells, and I'd wondered if when you originally were making this, building it, did you think of doing it with anything else?
No. Actually, for years, I had been collecting seashells. And so that, you know, I had them all over and I had to do something with them. My wife was kind of saying, you know, it's either me or the seashells. So I had a, I figured that this would be a good place to put them. You know, the manure has actually had over the 20 years a little bit of people being a little bit, not violent, but graffiti. They've tried doing certain things, and I've never given any credit to anybody who's ever, you know, did something like they painted on it or tore down, because I didn't want them to have the recognition. So seashells just seem to be a wonderful way to display it and be strong, because seashells are pretty strong. They last.
Where do you find them, by the way? Because I know that every year you have to replace some of them, right?
You know, 25 years ago, there was a lot of shells on the beach. 95% of the shells in both the world's largest spinning dreidel and the menorah, I collected on the beaches of Miami Beach.
Wow. Wow. And where else have you gone to get some?
Well, I've gone to Sanibel, I've gone to Marcos Island, I've gotten a few up in New England at places, and I've traveled actually to gather shells. It's always been something. I do other shell sculptures also, so this just became a very natural way to display my own limited, maybe, creativity.
Oh, not limited at all, definitely not. What it, remind people of what those sculptures, I mean, at the very core, what they're made of.
Well, you know, they're made of wood and steel and concrete. And the dreidel is particularly interesting because it is the world's largest spinning dreidel, and it's on a point. So there was a little bit of engineering there, and I had to contact a friend who knew a lot about this type of thing in order to get it spinning and keeping it on a point. And the idea was to, well, I knew that I had to go and put a preservative down. And every year it takes me about 2 or 3 weeks to bring it back into, you know, a proper looking good again. So it needs to be restored every year.
And you know, I wondered, because I mean, I'm reading about your life. I mean, your wife had passed a few years ago. How you celebrate this time of year?
Well, I celebrate it with family, certainly, and friends. I think that, and just going down to the menorah, making certain that the oil is in there. You know, this is one of the only menorahs in all of South Florida that actually is lit with a flame. You know, most of them are just, you turn on the light bulb for each day.
Right.
But this one has a huge flame, and so it makes it very interesting. As a matter of fact, when they light it every year, it's always whether or not they're going to be able to get that last torch lit. But they always do, and it's kind of part of the whole feeling of seeing this huge menorah being lit by, and it's lit by people who, you know, sometimes it's lit by every year by the mayor or commissioners, or if the governor's in town or a celebrity, they have always looked forward to lighting one of the torches in the menorah.
You know, I'd imagine that you've got to enjoy just watching people as they admire the work. And as you said, you've seen so many people out there over the years. You know, what are some of the things that you've seen that are most memorable?
Yeah, I would say this, that I'm very, very appreciative that I was given the opportunity to make this. Sometimes the people I see there, I get a kick out of it. One time, I hope this is okay, I saw a kind of like a Playboy bunny that was posing in front of it. But families. And I also was very, very gratified this was 2.5 years ago, when 6 Muslim men were praying to the east in front of it. And it just gave me such a wonderfully warm feeling that people, regardless of their religion, could understand that this is a festival of light. It's a message that everybody has. And I've just been extremely appreciative that I, who have had the opportunity to build this and to get so much, you know, it gets a lot of coverage, and it's become one of the best known sculptures in South Florida.
Yeah. How much longer is it going to be out there?
Well, we're keeping it out for another few weeks. It's part of the holiday season of the Christmas tree and the nativity scene, which is on Lincoln Road, and this is part of it. So we always feel that, you know, this is going to be kept there as part of this season, and it's just an important place in Jewish history, and I'm delighted that it's been able to stand up over those last 20-some years.
And so are we, absolutely. The beautiful sculptures, the menorah and the dreidel, made out of seashells out there on Lincoln Road in Miami Beach. And as Roger said, they're going to be out there for a few more weeks, so take advantage of the opportunity. Roger, thank you so much for sharing the story with us, and you know, that we could continue to share in the beauty of those sculptures, hopefully for a very long time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed speaking with you. I appreciate it.
And again, he is Roger Abramson. He is, again, the artist of the two sculptures of the giant menorah and dreidel out there on Lincoln Road. You can check them out. They'll be out there for a few more weeks, and learn more about them on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we've got questions surrounding a Republican nominee running for Congress. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thank you again for your support during this membership campaign. Well, in the race to replace former U.S. Representative Alcee Hastings in Congress, a candidate named Jason Mariner won the Republican primary, but not so fast. There are some concerns that Mariner may have voted illegally. He's a convicted felon, and the state of Florida can't tell if he's eligible or not, or how that could affect his candidacy. Still, he's the nominee facing off against Democrat Sheila Sherfalus McCormick in the special general election in January. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero investigated this story, and he started by telling us about Mariner's past.
He has been very upfront about the fact that he struggled with addiction in the past. He's spent time in jail. He's been convicted of several crimes. And now he says he's come out on the other side of that, and he wants to participate in civic life. He won the Republican primary for Florida's 20th congressional district. He's become very involved in politics. And a lot of what he's running on is the fact that he's not like other people. He's been through the bottom. He's had a knee on his neck, as he put it before. So he's running on as a Republican, but not a typical Republican, on his backstory and the fact that he's turned his life around.
And we talk about, you know, where he's been. He's a convicted felon. What is the story about him stealing paintings by the Florida highwaymen?
Right. So this was something that happened 10 years ago in Delray Beach. There was a woman who had a house that she owned, and basically they were moving things out of the house, and they were holding a lot of pieces of art in that house while it was vacant, almost as a storage. And Jason Mariner, while it was being used as storage, broke into that house, broke a window, stole about $20,000 worth of paintings from the Florida highwaymen and also a bunch of other local artists. And it was a lot of money. It was worth a lot of money.
And just to mention, too, by the way, the Florida highwaymen, this is a group of African-American artists known for their depictions of Florida beaches, swamps, forest, all of this.
Right. Very, very iconic Florida artists, very well known. You know, each one of these little paintings, they used to sell for a few dollars on the highways. That's why they're called highwaymen. But now they auction for several thousand dollars at auction houses.
So Jason Mariner served time, then he got out, but how does that impact his ability to run?
So the question of does this impact his ability to run is a good one. The campaign has made the argument that because this is a federal race, it's not a state race, that it actually doesn't impact his ability to run. But if he was running for something at the state level, it seems pretty clear that he would not be able to run because he hasn't petition to the cabinet and to the governor to get his civil rights restored.
When did you first hear of concerns that he may have voted illegally in at least one election?
I actually received a tip about this story. Someone was going back through the court filings and basically sent me an email and said, hey, a lot of people are assuming that he regained his right to vote because he made several payments, and that's the latest thing in the court docket. But when you look at it, those payments that Jason Mariner made was actually court fees and costs, and he had to make those in order to get his driver's license reinstated. But once you went a little bit further back into this one charge for the grand theft for these paintings, there was the judge in that case actually ordered that he pay $14,500 in restitution for that, because some of the paintings were recovered when the police actually found the secondhand shop that he sold them to for a few hundred dollars. But there were several of these paintings that are, you know, highly valued that are still outstanding, still missing. So he owed $14,500 in restitution. I actually found the victim of that crime who had the painting stole from her. And she told me she has not received a dime, no money in restitution. And she's rather upset about that still.
Do we know, did he vote in the 2020 presidential election?
He did vote in the 2020 presidential election. The supervisor of elections office in Palm Beach County verified that to me. He registered to vote earlier in 2020, cast a ballot. You know, the reason that we're bringing this up is because a couple of years ago we had this major court battle in Florida after Floridians passed Amendment 4, and then the state passed a law, and basically it ties the right to vote to paying all your court costs, your fines, your fees, and your restitution. And so in this case, I talked to the victim of the crime, who told me he did not pay his restitution, raises questions about whether that vote that Jason Mariner cast in 2020 was illegal. You know, he says it was under his assumption, and he believes that he paid the restitution when he got out of prison in a work release program. He said he was working and making payments, whatnot. But the state has not been able to verify that. And that goes back to a lot of these swirling questions that we were talking about when there was a big federal lawsuit and people were saying this was a poll tax. The state still doesn't know what it's doing here.
Again, finding out that he voted, I mean, it was interesting because after weeks of reporting, you found that the Florida Department of State and the Florida Department of Corrections couldn't tell you if he voted legally or not. What were those conversations like?
Right. So to back up, I mean, this was what was at heart in this big federal lawsuit that we had last year. A big part of the lawsuit against the Florida law that was passed after Amendment 4 was passed was that there's no way for anyone to verify if they're eligible to vote or not. There's no state database that tracks these payments. There's no website you could log into. There's no one office that tracks it. So it's all been haphazard. And this was the core issue in the federal lawsuit. And the state said, just trust us. We're going to come up with some kind of a system. We're going to get this done. And in this case, after weeks of asking the state, hey, can you verify that either this restitution has been paid or it's not been paid? I talked to the victim. She says she hasn't been paid. The state has not been able to answer that question. They have, to the best of my ability in my reporting and all the communications I've had with them, they have no way of tracking this.
So what can we say as to what can these state agencies say about Mariner?
They can say that he voted. They can say I can say, because I went back through the court records, to say he owed all this money in restitution. Mariner says he believes that he paid the restitution. But when it comes to confirming that, it's basically you're hitting a brick wall. You know, I'm able to confirm what I can confirm as a reporter. But ultimately, this is a legal question. This is why we have a state government. You need clarity on some of these questions. Was this someone that voted legally under the laws that were passed in the state of Florida? Or was this someone that voted illegally under the laws that were passed in Florida? And the state should be the one to determine these questions. And right now, in the system they set up with this law they passed, they do not appear to have the ability to do that.
Was your takeaway from doing this piece that things haven't really changed?
Yeah, things have not changed at all. All the things that we were talking about in the lawsuit, the things that the state was saying, just trust us, we're going to figure it out. They have not figured it out. And, you know, I'm pointing it out in this case, it's high profile. He's a congressional candidate. But this is actually something that thousands of Floridians are dealing with every day. People cannot figure out if they can vote or not. Because you might have had a crime that you committed 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and you can't remember what payment you made. You just can't remember. So if you can't confirm it, you're going to be less likely to vote, because if you vote illegally and a prosecutor decides to come after you, that's another felony. So the state needs to be able to, on a practical level, just tell people, can you vote or can you not vote?
So again, right now, the process for someone like him to get his right to vote restored is what?
Technically, it would be paying what you owe. And for his case, it would be the restitution. That's all you have to do in Florida. It sounds easy enough, but if you can't confirm it, people are going to err on the side of not voting, even though they maybe do have the right to vote because they can't confirm it.
And again, that was WLRN reporter Danny Rivero discussing with us the Republican candidate for the Congressional District 20 seat. That's Jason Mariner. And you could read more about him and our reporting on this on our website, WLRN.org. And that's Sundoff for this Monday, December 6th. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And of course, the theme music for the show is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at GoBalo.com. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, researchers believe the new Omicron variant is likely already in Florida. We're going to be joined by an expert to talk about what you need to know. Plus, cruise ships are back in Key West after more than a year of being absent, but new limits approved by voters are cutting back the industry's influence. All of that tomorrow on Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute and also by people, listeners like you.